Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming Outlander series or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 22 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So announcements this week. Because this is our special Burns night episode, we are posting it a day early. So
we can be on Burns Day.
That's right. We wanted to be on Burns Day. So announcements, instead of running, you know, basically Monday to Sunday, are going to run Monday to Saturday, and then next week we'll cover up with anything we may have missed. And make next week's announcements Sunday to Sunday. But here we go. Outlander Instagram posted some lovely pictures this week, starting off with a picture of Fleet Street Bloodworks drying blood fresh, which immediately made me think of Sweeney Todd. I'm assuming that's an intended tie-in.
I hope so, because I never said the words, but when I tweeted the URL, or I guess Facebook / tweeted the URL, of the image, I think I said, "Be careful the company you keep, ... on Fleet Street." And no, I didn't mention Sweeney Todd, but I'm hoping
it made me think
some people...
I'm assuming that the company who's making the blood has to...
I mean, come on, blood and Fleet Street. There's just no other connection in my mind.
Completely. So I thought that was clever. It's kind of gross looking. Ailey, friend of the show, Ailey Grant, she sang at a Robert Burns humanitarian concert earlier this week, and she performed along with Eddie Reader, Little Fire, Gemma Kate, and Sean Kennedy. So she linked to two videos, to two of the songs she sang, and she sang When You Are Old and Wild Geese, parenthetically Norland Wind. Beautiful music by Ailey Grant. So check those out. Like I said, they're linked to our Facebook page, and you could probably also find them on her Facebook page if you find her Facebook, which I totally recommend because she is adorable.
I did share from her page. I shared her her post.
And Matt Roberts was posting some good pictures this week.
As always.
There's a lot of stones, a lot of rocks this week, and I think even he was like, all right, no more rocks.
Yeah.
But he posted like a kind of a cobbled walkway that said that Hewan and Katrina walked this road. And then another one which was like he's kind of in the
depth of the forest.
Kind of looking toward a scene being filmed, and he says, "Behind the scenes filming. Way, way behind the scenes."
Yeah. Way, way behind the scenes.
Which I can't even begin to zoom in on, so I have no idea what's going on that far away. But it was really pretty. Again, composition, well done. Diana posted a picture, a profile picture of Sam with his brilliantly red hair. I think everyone could...
That's like probably one of the reddest haired shots we've got.
Correct.
Very nice.
But I think she called him Rojito.
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 Why do I don't speak Spanish, but whenever I try and pronounce a Spanish word... Because I have had some training in Italian, I sound like I'm trying to speak Italian.
No, you know what I want to say?
What?
You just admitted that you don't speak Spanish, yet anytime I speak poorly spoken Spanish, you try to correct me.
Just because I don't speak it doesn't mean I don't know how to pronounce. Maybe because it didn't sound like Italian.
Maybe.
Oh, gosh. Our ears.
All right, so I think the most important news of the week is that Outlander begins filming in February. So we're back to filming, which is fantastic.
It was just nice to get
it. Well, we knew it was
going to
happen, but I like the officialness of it. There was a cute video posted this week by TV Guide magazine called Cubicle Confessions. A little video with, it looks like a little interview with Sam and Katrina.
And I think it's, well, because it's TV Guide, it's pretty much understood that it was taped while they were there in LA. I mean,
It could have been in Los Angeles, or it could have been in New York.
Yeah.
Because they were in New York immediately following. There was a new How to Speak Outlander video this week.
Oh, my goodness. And you know what? The highlight, unlike the other two, this one We'll get to Sam in a moment. Sam did not take the spotlight. I have to say, Summer will explain the bits, the content. Graham McTavish and Gary Lewis,
you know what?
Were the best. They were
all.
Awesome.
Here's what I'm going to say. They filmed all of Graham McTavish's
spots.
Little bits at the same time. Either that or he is always eating a cookie.
I think he was eating the same cookie. Or at least the same dozen or something.
Because he is, every video they've shown of Graham McTavish and Gary Lewis, A, they're always together. And he's always got
at
something
least
in
Graham
his mouth.
Is speaking more.
Yeah, but he still has
I mean,
always,
he's
talking
what?
Through whatever's in his mouth. He's
yeah.
He's been eating in every clip they've shown of him so far.
That's funny.
Which may come from his dwarf training in The Hobbit. But it was very cute. And I will say that in this one, they kind of...
What were they trying to teach us?
I'll get there. This one was fun because they showed a lot of... There was footage from the actual The Fan event in Los Angeles.
Yeah, we saw them filming.
We saw them filming. We didn't know what they were doing.
We were so far away, we did not hear what they were asking.
But so it looks like they were going up and down the line and trying to get the fans to pronounce this Gaelic phrase.
And there may be more that we didn't hear.
Right.
I mean, they could have used the fans for other things that are coming up.
There may be more. But,
yeah,
so this one, the phrase was Monian Down.
I think so.
Ish. And I really think that Sam is becoming more and more smolderific with every week. Like this one, it was like, yes, this is the way this phrase is. And it almost seemed like it was affectation at this point. Like, the rest of them almost, it felt like he was kind of taking it seriously. This one, it didn't feel like he was taking it seriously at all.
I loved it.
Oh, for sure.
He took the smolder and ran with it.
Right.
But I'm like, nothing smolders like that smolder shot. I mean, even now, that video did not beat the smolder shot, even though it's a still.
Mm-hmm.
But
the baby maker
the
shot?
Baby. Hashtag,
hashtag
baby,
baby
maker.
That killed me.
Summer,
so funny.
Summer actually liked that. Summer sometimes likes stuff that I tweet, but that one, she texted me and said, that was funny. So I say, thank you.
You just texted her and said, hashtag baby maker, LOL.
Yes, and the funny thing was, I was sitting on that for 3 days. I thought, oh my gosh, wait, that's too much. That's too... Not offensive, but I thought, that's too much.
I mean, what did you have to do? Were you doing shots and that made you feel more...
No, was it... When was that?
I don't remember.
Me either. Anyway, I did sit on it for 3 days. Anyway, okay, on with the show. Did we say that?
No.
On with the announcements. Thank
Let's
you for your support.
Let's go on with the
okay,
show.
Ethel.
And lastly, this evening we got a lovely shot of a train, a misty train with a boom mic.
I did not expect her to say that. But it's so, obviously, it's part of the 1940s.
What was funny is, Gigi was showing me the picture earlier, and she goes, what is that? Is that a shovel? Is it like that?
No, I thought it was someone on the set, pretending to act and clean
and
up
like,
and broom and up broom and sweep.
You mean the boom mic?
So, yeah.
It's a boom mic. But no,
mic.
It's a great shot. I like the...
Oh, I
it's
love
kind
the
of
color.
Like steamy.
It's very summer.
It is steamy, like steam.
I know.
Why you gotta make it like that?
I'm not trying to make it like anything. You didn't say it's steamy and this and that. You said it's steamy and this and you were very
Why you gotta make this sexual?
I'm
it's
not.
A train.
Okay, this is gonna
it's
be.
It's a train.
Going through a
with
tunnel
with a boom mic. It's not sexual.
With a tunnel?
There's no tunnel. There's no tunnel.
Trains go through tunnels, Summer.
That train isn't going in a tunnel.
It's in still form. It's being still.
Of course
it's at
still
rest.
Form. It's a photograph.
Anyway. Okay, this will all be chiseled out.
Chisel that down.
I'll do what I can.
With that being said, that is the end of our announcements and on to our interview with our Scottish guest.
Here on the Outlander podcast, we welcome listener feedback. Sometimes we actually receive it. We're happy to welcome Arlen Donald, a Scot, who contacted us back in November. Here's a little snippet from his email with the subject line of, "So my wife suggested I email you." I'm not entirely sure what to actually say. I've emailed loads of podcasters about various things before. Anyway, I came across the podcast while bored at work and looking for something to listen to. My wife and I are huge Outlander fans. As a grumpy Scotsman, I was hesitant to like it and originally read the book with a marked plan to dislike it completely. Being 17 at the time, that worked wonderfully. However, my wife and I met while she was studying in Scotland, and after we started going out, she made me reread it with her, and I ended up loving the books. At any rate, I was finding myself having a love-hate relationship with the podcast, because you guys seem awesome and I love the content, but also I am grumpy and a complete know-it-all and history nerd, etc. So we were in the car and I was complaining about, they kept pronouncing it X, but it should totally be Y, and also how on earth could you interpret scene A in the books to mean B, because clearly it is more like C. My wife gave me that married look and basically said, honey, why don't you email them and tell them how to do everything in their podcast? And Arlen, I have to say, we are so glad you did. Welcome to the Outlander podcast. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you today?
We are doing actually quite well. Also a full day. Not as full as yours, perhaps, but quite a full weekend. And so, again, welcome. Please feel free to tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I grew up in Glasgow in Scotland. My family's originally from northeastern Scotland in the Kincardineshire area. But as the, you know, the tail end of the Highland clearances came around and more people were starting to lose their farms, my family sort of migrated southward and ended up in Glasgow. My wife and I met while she was on a scholarship in the University of Aberdeen. And I pretty much set my sights on her and relentlessly pursued her. Well, she kind of did the, you know, I'm only here for a year, I'm going to be sensible and date everyone I come across thing. but I ended up winning her over when we'd been dating probably 2 months. And she, you know, I knew she was an Outlander fan. I pretty much hated the books because while the majority of Outlander fans are awesome people, the ones that I had come across as a teenager were the sort of stereotypical loud American tourist with the giant camera wearing a Hawaii shirt, yelling about how quaint everything is and complaining that not every Scotsman they met was Jamie. And so, you know, as I said, I read the first book, determined to dislike it when I was about 16 or 17, and barely remembered anything from it and came away with the general idea of, well, I was completely right, that was terrible. And so my wife, then girlfriend, basically said, no, these are great books and you're going to like this. And so one day she lay on top of me and said, I'm not getting off until we read the first chapter. And by the time she'd finished, I was like, yeah, that actually wasn't too bad. Let's keep reading that. And so we ended up, we devoured all the books and we've read them all a number of times now. So we're eagerly awaiting the next one.
As are we, absolutely. I think all Outlander fans are. We cannot wait.
Dude, that cliffhanger in the last book was enough to make us all crazy, and it's been years since that book came out.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously we're not going to talk about the cliffhanger, because that's a spoiler for people who haven't read it, but we've been waiting anxiously to figure out what happened.
So I alluded earlier, I didn't allude to it, I full-on said it. You contacted us first in November, and part of the reason, and we've had an email conversation ongoing since, and one of the things that you actually have already done for us is provided us with some sound bites or some audio clips of you with certain pronunciation of things that we are very eager to share, but we didn't want to share them with someone who was disembodied and had not been introduced yet. So now that we have you here, we are happy to have you here in this episode. People will know to whom we are referring when we say, oh, and here's another clip from Arlen. We'll be able to have your background in there. And we are very happy to do that. We'll probably start maybe in the next few episodes.
Okay, sure.
So one of the things that interested us in your email, besides your feedback, was the fact that you actually, besides being a Scot, because of course not all Scots speak or have studied any Gaelic whatsoever, your background with the Gaelic. Could you speak a little bit about that? Like, tell us anything and everything about your experience with the language.
Well, you know, growing up in Scotland, that's kind of something that's always around, but unfortunately, the majority of people don't speak any Gaelic. There are actually more native Gaelic speakers in Canada than there are in Scotland.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you kind of grow up and it touches the street names and the areas you grow up in and, you know, things you chat about during the day. You know, one thing that people will say a lot in Scotland, if something's really good, they'll say it's smashing.
Oh, yeah, it's smashing, yeah.
And it wasn't until I grew up that I realised that didn't mean smashing, it meant smashing, as in smashing. And that's from the Gaelic, it means very good.
Exactly.
And I actually went to a primary school in Glasgow for my first year of primary school, which had a Gaelic-speaking half of the school and an English-speaking half of the school. And I always wanted to be in the Gaelic-speaking half, but at that point in time, they wouldn't accept you into the Gaelic-speaking half unless you'd already learned a fair bunch of Gaelic as a child. That's changed now, and they actively encourage people to send their kids to Gaelic school. They understand now, kids will learn it really fast. But we would have these joint assemblies together, and I would get to hear a fair amount of Gaelic. We often had entertainers who would come to entertain the Gaelic-speaking kids, and we'd all get to see. So, for example, I don't know if it's still on, but when I was growing up, there was a great kids' TV show. It was kind of like a Gaelic version of Sesame Street called Dotaman. And one of the main hosts from that show would often come, and he was, you know, one of those people who wore funny hats and sang silly little songs. And so I really, really wanted to learn Gaelic. And when I was in my late teens, early 20s, my elder sister heard that Glasgow City Council had started offering free Gaelic classes. And it was just this kind of overall thing the Scottish government was doing to try and revive Gaelic, because they were realising it was starting to die out in the country. And so you could go, you could pick which evening you were going to go, and there was one in a different area of town for each evening of the week, and you could just go and start and do, you know, the very first module of Gaelic and kind of graduate upwards until eventually you were officially fluent in Gaelic. And so I started taking classes there, and I went on and off until I moved to the US. I still consider myself very much a beginning Gaelic speaker. You know, I can have a really basic conversation, but I'm still at the point now where I can listen to the radio and understand more than I can actually say. But you start to learn the grammatical rules fairly early on, and that really helps a lot.
And that's actually quite common. It is a linguistic phenomenon when you're learning a language, is as you are learning, you will be able to comprehend more than you'll be able to produce. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm incredibly jealous of my wife. She's one of those people who picks up languages very, very easily. And I really have to work at it.
Did she pick up any Gaelic?
You know, she picked up a little, but what she picked up more of, the sort of, you know, linguists argue about whether or not the various Scots dialects count as a dialect of English or whether or not they're outright a different language.
Yeah.
And right now, the majority are leaning towards different language, but it changes every few years. And the one that's most common in the Aberdeenshire area is called Doric. It's English and Gaelic and a lot of Norse dialect mixed together. And my wife basically decided when she very first started at the University of Aberdeen, she was going to learn it. So she would go to a cafeteria every day where the two women that worked there would just chat away to each other in Doric all day long. And she would just go and get a big cup of coffee and sit there and listen to them until she could understand them. And it's, you know, it's very different from what people expect. They think of, you know, basically speaking English but with a really broad accent. But for example, in Doric, if you're saying hello to someone, you'll say "fit like." And if I recall correctly, the response is usually going to be something along the lines of "fit like a chavanawa."
Oh my gosh.
And so it's something that can be really incomprehensible until you've kind of grasped the different parts of it.
One of my interests is languages, and I would love to do an entire episode on just different, the language versus dialect issue, as well as whether or not they are languages or dialects. Just some of the different local tongues, if you will, including Doric, and the different types of Scots languages around the country. I think that would be very, very interesting, just to look at that.
You know, and it's definitely interesting, and there was such a progression, you know, where it went from, you know, we have no idea now what the Picts language would have been, although there are some educated guesses. And then the Gaels came in. It's believed probably to have been from Ireland, although it, you know, could have been from Spain. And then we ended up with a couple of mixed languages going on there. As the Vikings came in, we got even more languages. So, you know, for a long time, a lot of the islands in the north of Scotland were actually owned, for want of a better term, by Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And then were kind of won back over by Scotland. And so you've got some islands that are closer to Norway than they are to Scotland, but they're officially Scottish. And so they've had centuries where they mainly spoke Norn, and then they mainly spoke Gaelic. And now it's kind of a mixture of both of those and English. And So there's this really interesting and ever-changing map of how things are actually spoken throughout Scotland.
Speaking of those islands and the Norse influence, could you speak a little bit to Uphelia?
Uphelia is a festival that's held every year in the islands, and there are sort of smaller variants of it throughout different islands, but that's kind of the big one that's become the sort of official tourist one. And as it's grown, what it's kind of become now is just sort of a celebration of Viking heritage. And, you know, they usually have a bunch of guys in armour carrying torches. They build a long ship. And if I recall correctly, and I think they're still doing this, but it's been many years since I actually went to see it. Certainly when I was there, they basically built this giant longship and pushed it out onto the water and set it aflame. And so it was a really interesting festival. There's a lot of other festivals in the area that have similar Norse roots. One of the things they will often do in certain islands to welcome in the new year is they'll make these giant balls of tar attached to chains, and they'll basically set them on fire, and then they'll have a parade of people swinging these around their heads as they walk out into the bay and throw them out into the water. And so that's really something to see.
Sounds very dangerous, but it sounds very, especially it done at night, sounds like it would be spectacular to see.
It really is. And, you know, there's certainly other stuff that goes on. Like in the Orkney Islands, there's a very, very violent sport they play every year called the Orkney Ball Game. And basically they have a ball, and I believe they split the town in half, and I think they're referred to as the Uppies and the Doonies, but I may be misremembering. And so if you're from one half of the town, you're on one team. If you're from the other half, you're on the other team. And basically the ball gets thrown up in the middle of the air, and they have to grab it and get it to the other side. And it's incredibly violent, and it's just this huge press of people basically beating each other as they try and pass this ball slowly down. And it can take all day to do. And, you know, people get serious injuries and get crushed and have to be pulled out and taken to hospital. But it's such a huge part of the culture of the area that no one would ever think about trying to ban it, because everyone would do it anyway.
It sounds very, the brutality of it, it sounds kind of like something the Vikings may have done, you know, for sport.
Mm-hmm. And, you know,
it's kind of like rugby when you think about it.
It is, and, you know, there's similar things. Shinty is a game that's played in Scotland. Yeah. The Irish variation is called Hurley. And it's basically ice hockey played in a field with shorter sticks and more violent. And, you know, the thing I was always taught growing up, when you would go to watch a shinty match, you could tell which ones were the Scottish players versus which ones were the players who'd come over from Canada or America, because the ones from Canada and America wore a gum shield. And that was the extent of them being prissy and wearing body armour for this sport. And it's just, you know, it's a really hard, little, solid ball, and there's a lot of getting hit in the face with it and broken noses and stuff. And it's, you know, it's believed that it came originally from a game that the Celtic warrior class would play sort of in the off-season when they weren't fighting.
Wow, there's yet another episode of traditional Celtic sports. I mean, my goodness, it truly never ends. And that's why, yes, our goal is all things Outlander, but we definitely reach out and are interested in basically all things Scotland, period. So, okay, so besides being able to introduce you to listeners and find out more about you for ourselves, we are also happy that you are able to join us today, because we are going to speak a little bit about Robert Burns. Basically, we are going to hand the mic back to you, but just a little bit about Burns, from what we know basically about him, is that he's an extremely important figure in Scottish history, literary history, and cultural history. And some of his most famous songs or poems, as well as their music that they were set to, likely most people have heard of one, and that would be Auld Lang Syne.
They probably sing it every year.
They probably sing it every year.
Yep.
But some other ones that we noticed that, at least Summer, I think, recognized a few by the title. I've had the chance to perform a little bit on a Burns night opportunity a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Both of us recognize, of course, Red Red Rose.
Yeah.
And I recognize also A Man's a Man for All That,
yeah,
as well as Aphon Kiss. And, of course, then we had on our sixth episode, the lovely Ailey Grant, Scottish folk singer, shared with us her lyric, and that was something else that was the first time I'd ever heard of it and heard the actual song. That was quite nice. So with that is pretty much our basic understanding of this important Scot. But we would like to open up the mic and have you talk a little bit about him.
Well, you know, Robert Burns ended up being famous the world over. I don't know if it's still the case, but certainly a few years ago, with the exception of statues of saints, there were more statues of Robert Burns than there were of anyone else over the world.
Oh my goodness.
and I think that's kind of a testimony to how much Scots, when they move abroad, sort of become even more Scottish and start to really hold on to that stuff. He was actually just kind of a quiet young boy, farmer, not a lot of prospects. You know, he didn't come from a rich family. He didn't really, at least in the beginning, seem like he was going to end up being incredibly famous. But there were a few things that Robert Burns really liked, and that was poetry, drink, and women.
Excellent.
And he actually started kind of a sort of gentleman's club where the requirements to join be that you have a great love of women, a great love of drink, and a great love of words. And it was basically just him and his friends getting drunk and reciting poetry and singing a whole bunch. Mm-hmm. But on a deeper level, as he grew, he started to write about his everyday life. And as part of that came a lot of stuff that would now be considered almost socialist. He would write about how unfair it was that some people were born into poverty and had to strive for their entire lives, whereas other people were, you know, born into money and born into rank and had an easy time of it. One of his famous poems on that theme is one called The Twa Dogs, and it's basically two dogs talking to each other, and one of them's a beautiful, sleek hunting hound owned by a rich lord, and the other one's just a sort of quiet mixed breed working dog. And it's really an interesting medium to have that conversation about how different life is for some people. And so for a lot of people, he's referred to as the bard, but other people refer to him as the ploughman poet. He worked very hard as a farmer and kind of on the side worked as an exciseman, basically kind of collecting taxes and checking on imports and things like that. And his writing was something that he did on the side. And he did make money from it in his lifetime and certainly was published and well thought of, but he never got rich from it. He died a very young man. He actually died on the day that his youngest son was born. And he had made a lot of friends through his writing, and so they sort of fought for him to continue being published, and that's when his popularity really started to grow. So over the centuries, he just got more and more famous as people looked back to this person who had not just written incredible poetry, but had specifically done the majority of his poems and songs in the dialect which he spoke, which was, it's called Lallans, and it's the dialect of most of the south of Scotland. And so for a lot of people, it's kind of incomprehensible. And you read his poems, and there are some where you read it and it's very easy to understand, and it's a really sweet theme and you really, really like it. Things like Red Red Rose and A Fond Kiss. But then you get into other things like one of the more famous ones, Tam O'Shanter. It's kind of in the middle there, but there's a lot that people don't understand unless they grew up with Lallans being something that was spoken around them. And he fought for that throughout his lifetime and wrote a number of letters to various universities saying basically, you need to let people write in and study in their own dialect because otherwise it will eventually die.
So you say that once he became, as is usually the case in writers and poets and artists, etc., he became even more famous after his death.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading a little bit about him, and it actually mirrors what you were saying, and that is that he is by some seen to have been one of the forerunners of the Romantic movement,
mm-hmm.
as well as liberalism and socialism.
Yeah.
So that makes complete sense what you're saying.
You know, the Soviet Union at one point had a number of postage stamps that were all pictures of Robert Burns.
Oh,
and they would have their children study translations of Burns's poetry in school because they kind of held him up as, you know, this common man who was so intelligent and really fought for the cause. And that's kind of an interesting thing to think about, the first country to have a postage stamp of Robert Burns wasn't Scotland, it was the USSR.
Oh. That does give you pause, mm-hmm. because not necessarily that another country would use a figure from outside of their borders. That's, I guess, not unheard of, but to be the first to have used a Scottish figure and not be his own country,
yeah.
that's very intriguing.
You know, one of the things I think that really popularized Robert Burns and kind of helped the spread was after he died, some of his friends held the first ever Burns Supper. And, you know, nowadays they do tend to be held on the anniversary of his birthday, which would be 25th of January. Originally, they were held pretty much whenever people felt like it, but mostly on the anniversary of his death, which is in July. And so a few of his friends held this supper in his honour, and, you know, they basically ate good food, they drank and declaimed poetry and sang songs. It sort of grew from there, and, you know, one person would move away, but they would hold the Burns supper with people who hadn't necessarily known him personally, and it just kind of grew from there. And now it's a great national thing in Scotland, and the world over, people celebrate Burns suppers. There's actually, in Boise, Idaho, where I'm living, they have, I believe, the oldest continuous Burns supper in the United States.
Oh, wow. When did it begin?
I believe it's been going for 115 years now.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
And certainly the key to that is that it's the longest continuously running.
Sure,
I'm sure there were some held in the U.S. well before that. But it's become this thing where there's a very specific series of events when you have a Burns supper. You know, it starts out the same way. Traditionally, you'll eat the haggis, neeps, and tatties. You'll have someone, before you dig in, recite the address to a haggis. And one of my favorite parts is that they'll have the address to the lassies, where they basically have one of the gentlemen there read out something he's written, a poem or a song or just sort of a small essay, praising the women at the event and how, you know, interesting and smart and beautiful and talented they all are. And then traditionally they will have a woman do the response, and technically speaking, it's the response to the address to the lassies. It's become just the address to the laddies now, and it's very interesting to watch because some people really do it on the theme of Burns, where they have it just be really about appreciating the opposite gender and sort of praising them and a few sly comments here and there. I've certainly been to some where, honestly, they were outright sexist, and I was kind of horrified.
Oh, no.
You know, you just kind of, it's interesting to see how that changes depending on, honestly, and this may seem a bit nationalist of me, but it seems to depend whether or not it's someone who's ever actually been to Scotland saying it,
mm-hmm.
or someone who's just of the kind of, I want to wear kilt and drink a bunch of variety. So it's always very interesting to see, but certainly that gave a real rise to his popularity. There was actually a period where he was thought very badly of, and it really came from the fact that the person who wrote his biography after he died, the person who was basically paid to do that, was someone who hated him in life.
Oh, no.
And was very sort of temperate with their drinking and things like that, and so they thought very ill of him in general. And so for many years there was this idea of Robert Burns as just a horrible, constantly drunk, terrible, womanizing person. And there's certainly an element of that. You know, he had a lot of loves during his life, and they weren't all his wife. But for the most part, he was a decent person, and he liked to party and he liked to have fun, and I don't think there are many of us that can say we're never like that.
So you mentioned the address the haggis. How do you address a haggis?
Well, the story goes, and there's no actual official writing that he done to say this is why he did it, but the story goes that while he was working as an exciseman, he was kind of caught short travelling from one place to another and went to a cotter's house and, you know, needed to get out of the rain, get out of the storm, and they offered him what food and drink they had. And eating haggis is, it's kind of considered that it was originally, you know, the poorest of the poor ate it because it's made from the pluck, which is the kidneys, the liver, the heart, the lungs, of a sheep usually, but pretty much from any animal. And then it's kind of, it's minced up, it's mixed with onions and spices and pinhead oats, and then it's usually put into a casing or stomach and just kind of simmered until it's all cooked together. So it's basically a giant sausage. But, you know, having it be from those sort of lower class cuts of meat, it was considered a poor person's food. But he came to this house and they gave him what they had, which was, you know, haggis, neeps and tatties, and a little bit to drink. And he wrote a praise to this. Part of why he did it, we think, is because there was a period of time where there was a great movement of how much better foreign food was. And so there was a lot of French chefs and Spanish chefs and Italian chefs, and you kind of showed your wealth by how far away your chef was from and what delicate little treats they made. And so he wrote this as a sort of response to saying, our own food is good enough, and sometimes it may be all we have, but it's good, and the generosity that comes with it is important. And so he wrote this address to the haggis, which is kind of in praise of the meal itself. And that traditionally gets read out at the Burns Supper before you dig in. And for most Burns Suppers, what you'll have is they'll actually have someone pipe the haggis in, and you'll have a procession with the piper, and you'll have someone holding the haggis on a platter, and you usually have an honour guard of people carrying swords. And it's taken up to the head of the table, and then they'll have someone address the haggis and then dig in, and everyone gets to eat.
I've only been to one, and it was very much as you said. It was done with respect and an air of joy, a little bit of, not tongue-in-cheek. Everyone was having a good time, but it was a little bit solemn and had a nice mix to it. Mm. We wanted to know, would you like to declaim for us?
Sure.
Okay, awesome.
Would you like the address to the haggis?
I would love it.
Okay. Fair for your honest son see face, great chieftain of the puddin' race, aboon the ma ye tak your place, paint stripe or thern, we lord you worthy o' grace, as lang as my arm. The groaning trencher there ye fill, your hurdies like a distant hill. Your pin would help to mend the mill in time of need, while through your pores the dews distill, like amber bead. His knife, see, rustic labour dicht, and cut you up with ready slift, trenching your gushing entrails bricht like honey ditch. Then, ah, what a glorious sicht, warm, reeking, rich. Then, horn for horn, they stretch and strive. Deal tack the hindmost on they drive till all their well-swilled kites belive are bent like drums. Then, old Gidman, mayst like to rive, they thank it hums. Is there the Ori's French ragout, or oleo that would staw a sewer, fricassee that would mack or spew with perfect scunner, looks down with sneering, scorn for you on sick a dinner? Poor devil, see Maury's trash, as feckless as a withered brash, as spindle shank a gid whiplash, his knee a knit, throw bloody flood or feel to dash, ugh, how unfit. But mark, the rustic haggis fed, the trembling earth resounds his tread, clapping his wally knee a blood, he'll mak it whistle, in legs, in arms, and he'd heel sned, like taps a thristle. Ye powers wi' mak mankind your care, and dishes out our bill of fare, old Scotland wants nae skinking ware that jops and luggies. But if you wish her great for prayer, gie her a haggis.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yay! We're applauding here in the studio. We'll be sure to have a transcript of that on our blog.
Yes.
For people who'd like to see what that looks like. Now, speaking of that, is there a traditional text? I assume there is a text that everyone uses, but is there anything, are there different versions, or is it pretty much one accepted version?
There's pretty much one accepted version for most of Burns's poetry.
Okay,
often
excellent.
You'll actually find that he had four or five different versions that he played with during his life. So, for example, the traditional song that we sing, Auld Lang Syne, he actually preferred that to a completely different melody, but we now have the sort of accepted melody that everyone knows. And if you go online, there's actually a few videos of people singing it to the melody that Robert Burns himself preferred. And so that's always kind of interesting to see.
Absolutely. Straight from the horse's mouth, if you will, because it's always nice and interesting to learn about what artists or authors, the source, felt or implied about their own material. So now that we've had that, we've had you declaim for us how to address the haggis, we are going to follow up with one of his poems set to music, and that is Ailey Grant's Lyric. She's given us permission to play that again.
Wonderful. I was just going to briefly say that the one thing that kind of difficult with a lot of the Gaelic phrases in the book, and I'm really going to be kind of interested to see how they deal with it in the TV series. It seems like they've got someone who really knows their stuff to work on it all. A lot of the Gaelic phrases are ones that the author herself kind of came up with, doing her very best using a Gaelic dictionary, which, as you know, if you've ever tried to kind of speak any foreign language using just a guidebook, is you miss out on a lot of the grammar and a lot of the colloquialisms. Yeah. But one of the other things is she came up with names for places like the castle with words that are basically made up words, and they sound like what somewhere in Scotland might be called. And so that was one thing where I always kind of had to guess at. And going by the certain dialect of Gaelic that I studied and I learned, the castle name would probably have been pronounced either Lough or Lich. I think probably when she was writing it, she wanted it to be pronounced Leach or Leach. And so I'm very interested to see how that sort of thing's dealt with. And it makes it very interesting reading the books with that in the back of your head going around and saying, okay, well, I know that that's not grammatically correct, but I've seen that she changed that in the further books. But once in a while you come across something and you just kind of have to guess at how she intended it to be pronounced, how it would probably be pronounced, and then think about what they're going to do in the show.
That's true. And I remember, wasn't it at the very beginning of the fan event, when Ron Moore was introducing those artist renderings, he mentioned a few times the castle name.
He pronounced it Leic.
And it sounded almost, it did not sound, fair warning here. No, it did not sound like Castle Lick. No. But it almost sounded like Castle Lick. It was like Castle, either if it was Leach, it was very short on the aw. It was like Leach. I can't even Leach. Leach or something.
It was clearly a K on the end when he said it.
It was a hard C sound, a K sound, and it was no German or Scottish Loch sound on the end at all. What you say reminds me about how he said it. Mm-hmm. We had a great time. So it was interesting about the pronunciation, and I hope that they continue to do these How to Speak Outlander.
Yeah, that's little been really interesting.
Yeah, and not just the pronunciation, but a very brief definition of what that word is, like the Sassenach or something like that. Mm-hmm. So,
I also like that they're done tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, yes, definitely. They are educational as well as entertaining. Yes. So, yeah, they're very, the Gaelic instructor or the Gaelic expert comes out and tries to introduce it, and then Sam's like, no.
He's like, no one's going to learn Gaelic if I don't smolder.
I have to stand there and smolder so these women and will listen. Exactly. Although I have to tell you, yes, Sam does it nicely, and Sam looks very pretty. But he does. But I like the Gaelic. I think the Gaelic instructor does just fine. Or the Gaelic expert. He does just fine.
You know, and I would be willing to bet people learn more when he's on the screen rather than when they're paying attention to Sam smoldering.
That's true. That could be like a backfire thing. They bring in Sam because they know it will attract the people in, the ladies. Mm-hmm. But you're right. They're not going to be listening to the way he pronounces it. They're going to be... Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, you know, I have a friend who's from Northern Ireland, and she once said to me that she thinks that the thing that makes the Scottish accent sexiest is that you often can't understand what they're saying. So you can just imagine it's really sexy things.
I like that.
And so I think having someone on there who's very clearly showing you exactly how to pronounce it is definitely good, because Sam could be saying anything for most people watching.
That's true. Although I do notice, I think because of his, although he studied at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Dramatic Art in Glasgow, although he did study there, and although he was born and raised in Scotland, he has spent a lot of time in London and of course,
learning.
I don't know if trying to get rid of it, but to widen his professional opportunities, acting-wise, he definitely had to master the English accent and be able to, and probably local accents as well, but probably to not get rid of his Scottish accent, but to mask it as much as possible, so it doesn't pop up in the middle of some English drama somewhere.
You know, that was one thing that really concerned me when he was first cast. I went and found a couple of videos on YouTube where it was just him being interviewed, and to me he sounded outright English. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly changed now that he's been back in Scotland for a while. But, I mean, my own family, I moved here and I very quickly developed I'm speaking to Americans accent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I went back for my mom's funeral a couple of years ago, the first thing one of my sisters said when she saw me was, "You sound just like an American."
Oh my goodness.
And so it's kind of, there seems to be a sliding scale, but You know, in the books they do say that Jamie has that sort of cultured accent, and then when he gets angry it goes into the Scots, and it makes me think of, have you ever seen the film The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie?
No. Now we will have to.
It's a wonderful film, and the main actress in it, who is one of my very favourite actresses, she actually was told, you know, that the person you're playing is a cultured Scottish woman, so she has a very, very sort of cultured Edinburgh accent. And a friend of hers had, I believe it was a mother or an aunt, who had that very accent and lived in Edinburgh. And so she called and said, you know, I've been told that you have the perfect accent for this, where you have a very polite, cultured Scottish accent. And so Maggie Smith says to her, I would really like to be able to chat with you for a while to practice the accent. And the response that Maggie Smith got was, I have been told that I have no accent whatsoever. Mm. And yet, if you ever actually listen to that accent, you can tell it's definitely a Scottish accent, but it came from a period of time where people tried very, very hard to cover that, to show that they were of a higher class. I have a friend he's an older gentleman. He lives in the Highlands. And he went to Gordonston, which is the school that Prince Charles went to. And it's a very, very posh school in Scotland. And it was very much expected that you would come out of there sounding like an upper-class English gentleman. And this gent, he is Scottish through and through. He worked as a ghillie on an estate for a number of years, but just to hear him speak, you know, you would not know that he was born and bred in the Highlands of Scotland.
Oh my goodness. It's so, you know, without getting into the politics of that, or the, you know, the social class issues, it's just from a purely anthropological view, outsider looking in viewpoint, I find it fascinating, because I know that attitude is in every culture. It exists to some extent, I think, in every culture as far as what one accent means to the world, or what one person perceives, or what a class perceives one accent to be or not. So it's very, that's also very interesting to me as a linguist and as someone who, just as a listener, I listen to so many things. And again, I'm not saying it does not exist here in the U.S.
No, it totally exists.
It totally exists in the U.S. It may not be as, and I say this with air quotes, as advertised or as discussed as much as it is in the U.K., where it's, and I don't mean this in any negative fashion, but it's blatantly known. There's no hiding the fact that this exists in the U.K., whereas in the U.S., we know it exists, but it's just not spoken about a lot.
Well, and I would say a large part of that comes from the sort of the U.S. idea of the American dream of, you know, be you ever so low, you can still rise, and if you work hard, you can become a millionaire and send your kids to private school.
Exactly.
And so I think that's probably why it's less spoken of and known here.
But it's just as interesting. Well, thank you, Arlen, so much for joining us. We have had a fabulous time learning more about Burns, and also about a little bit more about your own background. And we look forward to including your audio clips and to getting even more audio goodies from you as we proceed into, God willing, this book, yes, but further books and further Gaelic.
Definitely.
Well, thank you so much. That was awesome.
No problem. You guys have a good one.
Oh, thank you. You too. Have a great day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com. I dreamt it last night.